This is Stuart Allen speaking from the Chapel of the Open Book, Wilson Street, London. Continuing our studies in the prophecy of Ezekiel, chapter 3. At the end of our last study, we saw that symbolically the prophet was given a roll and he had to eat it. And it had a twofold result. He found it first of all sweet and then the opposite, bitter. Very much like the Apostle John did centuries later. He also had to consume a roll or a scroll. And he found it sweet to his taste and bitter afterwards. Sweet because in both cases it was God's word, it was truth, but bitter because it was a message of judgment and condemnation. We don't have any trouble, I don't think, with the symbolism because we've said before, we have a figure very much like it when we talk about digesting effect. If you look at chapter 3, you will see God puts it to the prophet without any figure at all. Verse 10. Moreover, he said to me, Son of man, all my words that I shall speak to thee, receive in thine heart. Now that's the equivalent of eating the roll. Receive in thine heart and hear with thine ears, and go, get thee to them of the captivity. And the Lord said, you must deliver this message to them, whether they like it or whether they don't like it, whether they're ready to listen or whether they refuse to hear. But he's told them beforehand, he said, they won't listen to you because they won't listen to me. If they don't listen to me, they will not listen to you. Verse 7, but the house of Israel will not hearken unto thee, for they will not hearken to me. For all the house of Israel are impudent, are stubborn, and hard-hearted. Then the prophet sees another vision, another look at the wonderful glory of the cherubim and Jehovah that he describes in chapter 1. Then again, in verse 17, the Lord tells him, I've made you, I've set you as a watchman unto the house of Israel. Therefore, hear the word at my mouth and give them warning from me. There's a great stress in this prophecy on a twofold responsibility. The responsibility that Ezekiel had, and in this context God tells him, if you don't faithfully warn them, I'm going to hold you responsible, Ezekiel. The man, the sinner, his blood will I require at thine hand, verse 18. But if you do warn them, then you've delivered your own life. You've delivered your own soul. Now, of course, in the old days, in the time of the Pentateuch, it was written that the sins of the fathers were going to be visited upon the children to the third and fourth generation. Now, God says that's finished. From that, you see, there was a proverb in Israel, and both Ezekiel and Jeremiah referred to it, the fathers have eaten sour grapes, and the children's teeth are set on edge. The children are suffering because of the father's sins. God says that's going to happen no longer. Everyone is going to suffer for their own sins. It's the soul that sinneth, it shall die. Individual responsibility then is going to be stressed very much in this prophecy. Let's go ahead of it and turn to chapter 33. We have another context which is dealing with the responsibilities of a watchman, someone that sets upon the tower and watches and guards and looks after the people, watches for the approach of the enemy and warns them. Again, the word of the Lord came to me saying, Son of man, speak to the children of thy people, say to them, when I bring a sword upon the land, upon a land, if the people of the land take a man of their coast and set him for their watchman, and then comes several verses as to what his duties should be as a watchman. Verse 6, but if the watchman see the sword come and blow not the trumpet, and the people be not warned, if the sword come and take any person from among them, he is taken away in his iniquity, but his blood will I require at the watchman's hand. So, you can understand verse 7. So thou, O son of man, I have set thee a watchman unto the house of Israel. Therefore thou shalt hear the word at my mouth, and shalt warn them from me. So you see, it was no light thing to be a servant of the Lord. He'd got an unpleasant message to give very often. He might be tempted to smooth it over or to say nothing about it because it would upset the people. But he mustn't do that. God says, I will hold you responsible if you don't make the truth known, whether it's pleasant or whether it is not pleasant. So coming back to chapter 3, we get the duties of a watchman stressed in the verses that we've been looking at. Now down to verse 22. All I'm going to try and do, by the way, is to give the gist of these chapters. I can do no more. This, again, is a long prophecy, and we should be spending a very long time on it otherwise. And the hand of the Lord was upon me, and he said to me, arise, go forth into the plain, and I will there talk with thee. And so the prophet goes. He goes into the plain. And God tells him to do this. End of verse 24. Go, shut thyself within thine house. But thou, O son of man, behold, they shall put bands upon thee. They shall bind thee with them. And thou shalt not go out among them. That's the people. You're going to be restrained. And I will make thy tongue cleave to the roof of thy mouth, and thou shalt be dumb. Now this has led some expositors to the extraordinary idea that this man suffered from schizophrenia, double-minded, and probably epilepsy. And so he had to be physically restrained, and he was not fit to exercise the duty of a prophet. Well, that's going to very extraordinary lengths of interpretation. There's no need to do that. God is simply saying that he was to be silent, not that he was never to utter a word, but he was to be silent prophetically, which is a very different thing. God said, you will have no message to give the people from me. You're going to be dumb until I tell you, and then you shall open your mouth. So whether he spoke or whether he kept quiet was directly under the control of the Lord. Verse 26 we've read, but I didn't finish it. Thou shalt be dumb, and shall not be to them a reprover. That's to say, you will not exercise your office as a prophet. For they are a rebellious house. But when I speak with thee, I will open thy mouth. And thou shalt say to them, thus saith the Lord God. He that heareth, let him hear. And he that forbeareth, let him forbear, for they are a rebellious house. All that is being told the prophet here, the time to speak and the time to keep quiet, will be regulated by the Lord. There's no need to read anything else into it and make difficulties. Now the next chapters give you four acted prophecies, acted by the prophet himself, symbolically. This is rather extraordinary to us who are Westerns, because it's not our way of looking at things, it's not our way of learning. But not so to the Jew. They were the nation of type and shadow and symbol. It would not be strange to a Jew. It would be very strange to us. Now, when we read what God told this prophet to do, it'll sound quite extraordinary. The first thing he was told to do was to make a model of Jerusalem and to lay siege to it. He was to act out in front of the exiles in Babylon what was going to happen under Nebuchadnezzar in Jerusalem, when at last this judgment from the Lord fell through this man. But at last he came to the city, besieged it, and finally set it on fire, destroyed and burned it. Now he's teaching, the prophet's going to teach the exiles who were alienated, they were separated right over in Babylon, he's going to teach them symbolically what is yet to be. So God says, you make a model, take a tile, that is an ordinary clay brick, and lay it before thee, and portray or carve upon it the city, even Jerusalem, and lay siege against it, and build a fort against it, and cast a mound against it, and set the camp also against it, and set battering rams against it round about. He was to picture this in a model. Moreover, take thou unto thee an iron pan, better a baking pan, and set it for a wall of iron between thee and the city, and set thy face against it, and it shall be besieged, and thou shalt lay siege against it. This shall be a sign to the house of Israel." That's the first thing he had to do in acting out truth. I say it sounds extraordinary to us. Perhaps it sounds a little bit childish to us. But that's because we haven't got the outlook of a Hebrew. Now we come to a very difficult context. And I don't think, quite frankly, anybody has got the last word on this. I certainly have not myself. Let's read it. Verse 4. "Lie thou also upon thy left side, and lay the iniquity of the house of Israel upon it. According to the number of the days that thou shalt lie upon it, thou shalt bear their iniquity." Let me say to begin with what it does not mean. It does not mean that the prophet could actually bear the sins of his people. There was only one who could do that. The Lord hath laid on him the iniquity of us all. And in the immediate context, that was the people of Israel, of course. There's been no other sin bearer except the blessed Son of God. But this is symbolically. Again, he's acting out, you see. Symbolically, he was to bear the punishment that the northern kingdom, the 10 tribes, and the southern kingdom, the kingdom of Judah, were undergoing. For, verse 5, "I've laid upon thee the years of their iniquity, according to the number of the days, 390 days. So shalt thou bear the iniquity," that is symbolically, the punishment, "of the house of Israel." And so it looks as though he was asked to lay on his side for 390 days. Well, think that over to begin with. I wonder what you'd feel like if you laid on your side and didn't move for 390 days. Frankly, physically, I would say it was quite impossible, that no one would ever stand it. So what is the meaning? Well, we'll look in a moment. "And when thou hast accomplished them, lie again on thy right side, and thou shalt bear the iniquity of the house of Judah 40 days. I have appointed thee each day for a year." So the 390 days represent 390 years, and the 40 days represent 40 years. Obviously, it was impossible to ask him to lay on his side for 390 years. It's 390 days, each day representing a year. Now, what does that mean? Unfortunately, the text is confused. And when I tell you that the Septuagint reads 190 instead of 390, now, where are we? You see, the Septuagint translators were responsible men. Either they had a manuscript which was different from this, or there's been some scribal error somewhere. Some copyist has made a slip. Of course, you can understand how very easy that is. There was no printing. Just imagine everything being laboriously written by hand, hour after hour. Have you ever tried to do that? Copy something and keep on and on and on, hour after hour. Well, you're a very remarkable person if you don't start making little slips. You might drop out the little word A, or you might alter a figure accidentally, but easily be done. So, it could be a scribal error, but which is right, 390 or 190? Well, I say quite frankly, friends, I don't know. And I'm not sure that anybody else does either, for sure. Fortunately, there's this to help us, that this is really retrospective. It's not dealing with prophecy in the future. So I don't think we need be very perturbed about it. You see, it's not like, for instance, Daniel's image, which is a big sketch of the whole of the Gentile dominion, looking to the future from his day. This was something that was practically over in history. It was the length of time that God was judging the northern kingdom and the length of time that God was judging the kingdom of Judah. And they both had their end. Well, we know that as far as Judah was concerned, it was ended when the decree given by Cyrus was passed, that they should leave Babylon and go back to Jerusalem once more. So if we were to count back 40 from that, we ought to get somewhere. And if we were to count back 390, we ought to get somewhere, friends, but we don't. That's the point. It does not come to any notable time at all. It comes somewhere near some notable times, and so you may find quite a number of evangelical expositors who say that God is simply giving a round figure here. You mustn't try and take it exactly. But I have a feeling that something's gone wrong somewhere. I don't know that God ever does deal with round figures in prophecy like that. God's chronology is exact. I feel a little bit uneasy about accepting that. But I'm afraid we shall have to leave it. Now we'll wait upon the Lord, and if he's got further light to give, which doubts he has, it may be yet that we shall understand that. So from that I'm going to pass on. I'll leave the problem with you to see if you can get down to it and solve it. Not only that, but in verse 9 he was to take certain cereals for his food. And here's the point. How could he prepare his food for 390 days lying on his left side? Could you do that? Well, you say, what does it mean then? Well, I think what it means is this, that when he was in his house, and when he normally lay down, every time he was to do it on his left side for 390 days. And then after that, he was to do it for 40 days on his right side. One representing the northern kingdom, the 10 tribes, and one representing the southern kingdom. If you turn east and face east from Babylon, you'll see the left is looking north to the 10 tribes and the right is looking south to Judah, the two kings of which had become split after Solomon's death. And we know from the very prophecy that on a number of occasions the people came to the prophet's house and watched him acting, doing these things. He wasn't doing it just to amuse himself. He was doing it, we've been told, because he was assigned to the house of Israel. So when they came to watch him, they would see him lying down on his left side. Every time he lay down, he'd always lay on his left side. I do not think it's physically possible, nor do I think the Lord ever intended this man should literally lie there day and night for 390 days. It isn't possible. Or 40 days. But when he was acting the role of a prophet to the people, that is what he was required to do. Now, if you look at verse 9 and onwards, the food that he was to eat is famine rations. Because that's exactly what happened during Nebuchadnezzar's siege. When you study the book of Lamentations, you know the awful statements that are made there. It's the book of the description of the sufferings of the people of Israel under that siege of Nebuchadnezzar. Starvation. And parents even eating their own children. And here you've got starvation rations. Take thou also unto thee, verse 9, wheat and barley and beans and lentils and millet and fitches, but we should say vetches today, and put them in one vessel, and make thee bread thereof, according to the number of the days that thou shalt lie on thy side, 390 days, shall thou eat thereof. And thy meat or thy food, which thou shalt eat, shall be by weight, 20 shekels a day. That is, in our measure, about 9 ounces. You wouldn't get very fat on that, would you? 9 ounces. From time to time, thou shalt eat it. Verse 11. Thou shalt drink also water by measure, because water is scarce. The sixth part of an hin, roughly 1¾ pints. From time to time, thou shalt drink, and thou shalt eat it with barley cakes. Verse 13. The Lord said, even thus shall the children of Israel eat their defiled bread. He was acting out what they would have to experience. Eat their defiled bread among the Gentiles. Now the Lord had kept this nation separate from the surrounding nations. To have any dealings with them was to defile themselves. And now, as an act of judgment, God had turned them out of their land and scattered them amongst the defiled nations, and they'd become defiled themselves, God says. They're going to eat defiled bread among the Gentiles, whither I will drive them. And then, in verse 16, moreover, he said to me, Son of man, behold, I will break the staff of bread in Jerusalem. Now here's the reality that his acting was representing. And they shall eat bread by weight, and with anxiety, with care, because it's so scarce. And they shall drink water by measure, and with astonishment, or with dismay. And they shall want bread and water, and shall be astonished one with another, or, as the Revised Standard Version, shall look at one another in dismay, which makes more sense, and consume away for their iniquity or sin. So the prophet is setting up then, symbolically, what their brethren over in Jerusalem were going to experience very shortly after this was acted, it actually happened. We shall come to the point in the prophecy where news reaches them that this siege was actually taking place and Jerusalem had fallen and had been burnt and consumed. Now the next thing he was to act out, chapter 5. And thou, son of man, take thee a sharp knife, take thee a barber's razor, and cause it to pass upon thy head and upon thy beard. Then take thee balances to weigh and divide the hair. And thou shalt burn with fire a third part. And that's going to represent pestilence falling upon those left in Jerusalem. And there was going to be a third part. He was to smite it with a knife. That symbolically represented death by the sword. And the third part thou shalt scatter to the wind. This is the scattered exiles. Scattered away from the land over into Babylon. And I will draw out a sword after them. Now note, when it's explained, unfortunately for us, it is explained, and we always want to watch out for the explanation of symbols. It saves so much guessing, doesn't it? Verse 12. A third part of thee shall die with the pestilence, God says, and with famine. They shall be consumed in the midst of thee. And a third part shall fall with a sword round about thee. And I will scatter a third part into all the winds. That's the exiles. And I will draw out a sword after them. Thus shall mine anger be accomplished. And I will cause my fury to rest upon them. And I will be comforted. That sounds extraordinary reading, doesn't it? Revised Standard Version. I will satisfy myself. I will satisfy. This is God's righteous judgment upon this wicked and sinful people, and they shall know that I am the Lord, or they shall know that I, the Lord, have spoken it in my zeal, when I have accomplished my fury in them. Verse 14, I will make thee waste a reproach among the nations that are round about thee. They're just going to marvel as they look at you, and what's been done to you, and what you've been through. So, it shall be a reproach and a taunt, an instruction and an astonishment, Revised Standard Version, a warning and a horror to the surrounding nations that are round about thee, when I shall execute judgments in thee in anger and in fury and in furious rebukes, I, Jehovah, have spoken it. So that's the meaning of that second acted prophecy. Now chapter 6. God says, set my face against the mountains of Israel and prophesy against them. But why the mountains? Why prophesy to inanimate matter? Well, it so happened that nearly all of Israel's idolatrous worship was on the summits of mountains. They'd raised their groves and their idols and so on. And so God said, I'm going to deal with that. You prophesy against the mountains and say, you mountains of Israel, hear the word of the Lord God. Thus saith the Lord God to the mountains, to the hills, to the rivers, to the valleys, behold, I will bring a sword upon you. I will destroy your high places. Here it is. And your altars shall be desolate, and your images shall be broken. And I will cast down your slain men before your idols. God is going to judge them for this pagan idolatry that was so rampant at this time. Verse 7, and the slain shall fall in the midst of you, and you shall know that I am the Lord. Now here's a characteristic expression that occurs over and over again in this prophecy. You shall know that I am the Lord. it occurs 54 times, and in an expanded way, another 18. So that comes to 62 times. God keeps saying, you shall know that I'm the Lord. I'm going to do this, that, the other, so that you'll know. You'll have no doubt about it, that I am the Lord. Let's go right back to the beginning for a moment. Go back to the book of Exodus. In Egypt, when God was about to bring this people out, he tells Moses in chapter 6 of Exodus, verse 6, wherefore say unto the children of Israel, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, and I will rid you out of their bondage, I will redeem you with a stretched out arm and with great judgments, and I will take you to me for a people, and I will be to you a God, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God. So the wonderful act of redemption and deliverance from Pharaoh's bondage was that they should know something about him, the great Jehovah. You shall know that I am the Lord. Surely the knowledge of God is the goal of all truth. It matters not whether you're dealing with the Old Testament or the New. Let's go back to Jeremiah's prophecy a moment. Jeremiah chapter 9, verse 23. Thus saith the Lord, let not the wise man glory or boast in his wisdom, neither let the mighty man glory in his might, let not the rich man glory in his riches, but let him that glorieth glory in this, that he understandeth and knoweth me, that I am the Lord, which exercise loving kindness, judgment, and righteousness in the earth. For in these things I delight, saith the Lord. Getting to know God, the God, the one whose loving kindness and his judgment, his righteousness, and his love is so overwhelming. Well, that's one side. But to a nation that wouldn't learn, God says, well, you must learn the other side then. You must know that I'm the one that's going to take account of sin, and you're not going to get away with it. He had held back so long in his mercy and in his patience with his people. And so God can say in Ezekiel's prophecy, this judgment will fall, that judgment will fall, that you'll know that I am the Lord. It cuts both ways. When you come down later centuries to the Apostle Paul, his great goal was the same thing, was it not? That I may get to know him. That sums everything up. After all, what is there extra to knowing God, to knowing Christ? We want to remember that. It's not much good reading the Bible regularly. It's not much good attending meetings. If the total sum at the end of it doesn't bring us to a deeper knowledge of the Lord, that's the whole goal of it. And if that doesn't have some effect upon our thinking and our planning and our acting, we ought to be able to look back and say, well, I do know him just a little better. Know something of his gracious character, his wonderful dealings, and his wonderful leading for me. So, let's come back then to the prophecy of Ezekiel. We've just got time for a little more. God says, you shall know that I am the Lord. This occurs no less than 4 times in this chapter. Verse 10, and they shall know that I am the Lord, that I have not said in vain that I would do this evil to them. I'm going to do what I say, God says. If I say that I'm going to judge them and going to punish for their sin, it'll surely come. Again in verse 13, then you shall know that I am the Lord. And the end of the last verse of verse 14, so will I stretch out my hand upon them and make the land desolate, yea, more desolate than the wilderness toward Diblath, in all their habitations. And they shall know that I am the Lord. Now we must pass on. Chapter 8. Might you just have time to say a word about that? God brings now the prophet in a vision to Jerusalem. Note, I say in a vision. Because it's quite extraordinary the difficulties that some expositors have made, because they've assumed that Ezekiel literally went from Babylon over to Palestine, back again. They say, well, how did he do it? How did he get there? Well, he didn't. He only did it in a vision. Look at verse 3. And he put forth the form of a hand and took me by the lock of my head. This is the magnificent one that he saw in chapter 1. The man whose loins even upward had the appearance of brightness, the colour of bronze or amber. And the Spirit lifted me up between the earth and the heaven and brought me in the visions of God, there it is, to Jerusalem. You know when they're actually. This was a vision. And given to him by the Spirit of God. To the door of the inner gate that looketh toward the north. And he saw the glory of God there. Just as he saw in chapter 1, verse 4. The glory of the God of Israel was there, according to the vision that I saw in the plain. Then said he to me, Son of man, lift up thine eyes now, the way towards the north. So I lifted up mine eyes, the way towards the north, and behold, northward, at the gate of the altar, this image of jealousy at the entry. What does that mean? Well, it means the image that provokes jealousy on the part of the Lord. God is now, he's taken him to Jerusalem in a vision. What for? Well, just to show him the enormous sin that was then going on. He gives him four different pictures in Jerusalem of what his people were doing. The first one is in this verse 6. He said, furthermore to me, Son of man, seest thou what they do? Even the great abominations that the house of Israel commit here? Can you see that? Verse 10, so I went in and saw, and behold, every form of creeping thing and abominable beasts, and all the idols of the house of Israel portrayed or carved upon the wall, round about. And it was all done secretly, verse 12, in the dark. No wonder. Then the third one, in verse 13, he said to me, turn ye yet again, and thou shalt see greater abominations than that they do. And so the Lord takes him to the door of the gate of the Lord's house, the temple, which was toward the north, verse 14, and behold, there sat women weeping for Tammuz. Now, Tammuz was the Babylonian god of vegetation. Often, they'd reduced God Jehovah down to merely the god of fertility. Of course, perhaps we don't understand it so much in this country, but where so much depends upon rain and so on, you can almost understand people in their ignorance that know nothing about God, worshipping nature. But this is God's people that he'd expended his time. He'd sent prophets again and again and given them his truths. To them he committed the oracles of God. They had sunk so low as to do this. Tammuz was the god of vegetation. He was supposed to die in the heat because the vegetation died. He was supposed to come alive again when the rain started and revive the vegetation. And here's the women in Israel weeping and worshipping at the foot of Tammuz. The God says to Digger, do you see that? That wasn't the end of it. The fourth is in verse 16. He brought me to the inner court of the Lord's house, and behold, at the door of the temple of the Lord, between the porch and the altar, there were about 25 men with their backs toward the temple of the Lord, and their faces toward the east, and they worshipped the sun. Just common sun worshippers. Fancy Israel descending to that. Worshipping the sun toward the east. Then said he unto me, hast thou seen this, O son of man? Is it a light thing to the house of Judah that they commit the abominations which they commit here? But it had been. They departed so far away from the Lord. They got so involved with the nations round about, with their pagan idolatry. They'd assimilated it. They'd completely forgotten God. Jehovah. Amazing to think that a people could ever get that far. Is it any wonder that the Lord is telling this man that you'll warn them now against, or rather you'll warn them concerning my judgments against them, which are just about, as it were, to fall. Now in chapter 9 and in chapter 10, we shan't have time to deal with it, I don't think now, but in chapter 9 you have it, the destruction of Jerusalem given symbolically. For the prophet now sees six men and one man separate, which makes seven. And these are not men at all, they're angels. They're destroying angels. This isn't the first time in the Bible that angels have been represented or seen to be like men. So was the experience of Abraham. Men came to his tent door, and they turned out to be, after a while, angels, not human beings at all. And so you've got seven destroying angels, which God is going to use in judgment upon this city. The seventh is the one who has an ink horn, verse 2. One clothed with linen, with a writer's ink horn by his side. And he is the one that records this terrific judgment. But before the judgment falls, it's good to know there's always this faithful remnant. There's always just a few who have been faithful and have not, as it were, gone over to Baal and the idolatry round about. So in verse 4, the Lord said to him, go through the midst of the city, through the midst of Jerusalem, and set a mark upon the foreheads of the men that sigh and cry for all the abominations that be done in the midst thereof. You remember how a similar thing happens in the book of Revelation. The Apostle John gives a vision of the 144,000 who are sealed and protected so that when the terrific judgments of that book fall, they're unharmed, God is protecting them, they're sealed. So here they're sealed, a mark is set upon them, and they're protected. It's marvellous to think that no matter how dark the history of God's people, God has always preserved for himself a faithful remnant. Had he not done so, then of course his promises to Abraham, Isaac and Jacob could never have been fulfilled. Never could there have been a Messiah to come, had everyone been blotted out. God saw to it that sometimes it seemed to be reduced to almost nothing. Out of this great battle that's going between God and Satan. Satan working upon this people and bringing them to this awful state. So here then we have the faithful remnant protected before the judgment falls. And then you find Ezekiel the prophet pleading with the Lord, very much like Abraham pleaded with him over Sodom. Verse 8, it came to pass that while they were slaying them, this is the angels, while they were killing, and I was left that I fell upon my face and cried and said, ah, Lord God, wilt thou destroy all the rest of Israel in thy pouring out of thy fury upon Jerusalem? Then said he to me, the iniquity of the house of Israel and Judah is exceeding great, and the land is full of blood, and the city full of perverseness. For they say, the Lord hath forsaken the land, not the earth, the land, the promised land, and the Lord seeth not. He is not caring what's happening. That's what they said. And as for me also, mine eye shall not spare, neither will I have pity, but I will recompense their way upon their head. And behold, the man clothed with linen, which had the ink horn by his side, reported the matter, saying, I have done as thou hast commanded me. And in chapter 10, you are told how it was done. Again, symbolically, for one of the cherubim, we notice that in chapter 1, that one of the features of the symbol was a burning fire, a fire that flashed continuously. And from that fire, one of the cherubim takes the fire and scatters it over Jerusalem and symbolically destroys the city by fire. Now, let's look at the actual fact of this, where we've got no symbols at all. Let's go back to the second book of Kings, chapter 25. Chapter 25, verse 8. And in the fifth month, on the seventh day of the month, which is the 19th year of King Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came Nebuzaradan, captain of the guard, a servant of the king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem. And he burnt the house of the Lord, and the king's house, and all the houses of Jerusalem, and every great man's house, burnt he with fire. So that's the actual historic fact of it happening. Chapter 10 of Ezekiel gives you in symbol you find the cherubim actually scattering fire over this city, and therefore in prophetically showing them what God was about to do. And then at the end of the chapter, you find the glory of the Lord leaving the city, leaving the temple, deserting the house, because now God's withdrawing his presence from this sinful people. And not until the end does the prophet see that same glory and the cherubim returning. Now, I think that's as far as we can get in this study. We have brought before us then in the Old Testament this God who is faithful to his word at all times. He delights in judgment and loving kindness. He does not delight in judgment. In justice, in loving kindness and so on, yes, he does. He doesn't afflict willingly, we're told. But sometimes he has to do it. He has to discipline his people. And so we find him true then to his threats as he is to his promises. But how good if we can only so walk so closely with him that we shall not need so much of this hard discipline. We shall learn without the bit and the bridle. We have to have the bit and the bridle. Well, that's our own fault. That's all. But he doesn't want to deal with us like that. If we are keen to be taught, if we are sensitive to his voice and to his leading, we shall surely follow closely and respond all the time. These things, said Paul, were written for our warning. All the things that you read concerning Israel, they're all recorded in God's book to warn us and to save us from doing the same thing, so that we shan't suffer as they had to suffer.